this goes hand in hand kind of with, I guess, the development of historical thinking, which I hate talking about this with a lot, you know, with someone who isn't willing to think it through or to seriously consider what you're saying, because people just, you know, history is history. History happens. The 18th century, the Enlightenment, is the birth of the idea of history. It's misleading, or when you think about just in vernacular terms of what the word history means, is you can't understand this. Because really, before the 18th century and the late 17th century, there was chronology. That's what history was. You can say that there's kind of two levels that you can work on, where commonly you would tell history of objective events and that of one event causing another event. Like,
it's a passive thing, you know, it's just a record, I guess, of what happens. Never think of history as like an active thing that, you know, is unfolding.
Billiard balls striking one another. That's why those kinds of histories always focus on military battles and generals' conquests, emperors. They're very constrained in their way of approaching history, is that they have to focus on these objective events and they have to make these direct causal links between those events. But then with the Council of Trent is one of the big transformations in historical thinking. And that's when you get hermeneutics, as that's a way of approaching texts to critically evaluate them in an objective way to prove, for example, that the donation of Constantine is a forgery, right? That's when they invent these new textual methods that make more advanced modes of history possible. And so that's a whole thread that's beginning with Machiavelli, who's, he's the first one to foreshadow that change is going to happen. But then someone like Leibniz, of course, who is was a major historian who is working, doing the history of the House of Hanover and assembling all the textual sources for that. But then also Hume wrote his History of England, which was a politically motivated work designed to undermine the Whig historicism, the idea that before the Romans came over, that there was an original Anglo constitution. That's the idea that the Whigs used to underpin their idea of the Commonwealth, right? They're saying that no, the Norman kings, they can't have dominion over us. The Commonwealth is sovereign, and that is enshrined in our original constitution. And we don't have a record of it. It's not a written thing, but we're just saying that back in the old days, before the Romans were here, this was our constitution.
Yeah, which kind of like you have in a lot of more contemporary, like neo-Machiavellian currents, the whole kind of notion of like constituent power. Like, this has been kind of big in certain intellectual circles from like the 70s onwards. But here it's, you know, the constitution emerges on the basis of like constituent power. And so it's not necessarily that you need the like written constitution, but the constitution itself is an expression of something more fundamental.
Yeah, it's an idea of that sovereignty is inhered within a historical formation of a group of people. That's a really important move that's being made. And Hume actually opposes that on the basis of his metaphysical skepticism, because Hume is famously skeptical about the applicability of metaphysical categories like causality. And so he applies that also to historical arguments of this nature, where he doesn't believe that historical narrative can ever prove such a thing. And so he takes a middle ground in his History of England to actually reform the Whig histories. There's so many examples of different historical works, and the most important one is Voltaire's Essay on Universal History. And that goes into the whole idea of universal history and what is, when people say world historical, right? That means something very specific in my mind. You know, if you go back to the 18th century, you look at Schiller and his historical lectures when he was professor at Jena, or you look at something like Voltaire's Essay on Universal History, like world history means something very specific, and that they're no longer narrating the objective history of a physical institution or telling you how a certain law came into being or a certain institution was formed or a certain war transpired, is that now they're narrating the history of a subjective idea or spirit, you know, a worldview. That's what Voltaire's universal history is that he's narrating the history of an idea of the Enlightenment itself in their modern world. And that's a really profound change. But we use history interchangeably to refer to medieval chronologies, which are just like lists of dates and events. but we also use it to talk about modern works of history like Gibbon, or where it's making a much more complex argument based on the interaction of physical events with idea like Christianity and how Christianity affected the Roman Empire. That's something very different. That's like a quantitative change in the way that history is done.
Yeah, and I guess in a way you're talking about the chronology basically being lists. And when I read what Corneau is talking about when he talks about post-history, and I don't know, maybe it is almost kind of a throwback, a chronological. It's managerial. His idea of society is a big-ass registry.
Yeah, that's a common theme that develops in a lot of early historicist writing. Like Herder at one point says that that type of history that you're talking about is like an encyclopedia that represents the nullity of everything human, I think is what he says.
Oh, so yeah, then it works like absolutely perfectly together then. And I guess that's, we talk about like Arnold Galen, the German sociologist who like picked up on Corneau. He's probably drawing on exactly that line of thinking, because for him, it was just that Corneau offered something that was kind of absolutely dehumanizing, that there was no really ability to reflect upon anything anymore because everything's just kind of arranged into its proper mathematically determined place.
We can take this even further throughout this episode. We've been talking about themes of hypostasis and metaphorical overextension and idolatry and commodity fetishism and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to mention something with Walrus directly in conjunction with that, but don't let me interrupt you.
Oh, yeah, no, go ahead, because I wanted to talk a bit about how ideas interact with history and the mechanism through that, which is our belief in those ideas, right?
Right. Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's exactly the basis for something like the power of capitalism as an illusion. It doesn't actually control us. It's a hypostasis is the whole point. It's a fetishism where you're taking an idea and you're giving it power over yourself. And that's how the idea plays itself out in objective history, through the belief in it. It needs you to act on its behalf.
Yeah, like the Matrix. And something that is really kind of novel about neoclassical economics in that sense is, you know, we've talked so much at this point about value. And you know, like Marx really hones in on value as the crystal nugget of hypostasis. This is the holy grail that everybody's chasing, and then society starts to get organized around in all these different ways. And even though the neoclassical economics talks about being a break with classical economics, they still retain the notion of value. Their discovery of economic science as a true science, like something that is ultimately like a form of physics, it's all about discovering what value truly is. So they're still chasing this notion. And one of the things that August Walrus, the father, his idea was that value is just like the interplay of scarcity and utility, right? He called it like rarity, but he wanted to approach this kind of dynamic interplay quite literally through the prism of physics. And there's a great little quote where he basically tries to reconcile this like value with like the emergent theories of motion that were, you know, coming out from the physicists of the times. And the physicists were like intimately bound with the engineers. Those developments are very interwoven. So it makes sense, you know, given the engineering background of these people. But he said, just as speed is the ratio of distance covered to the time taken to cover it, so rarity is a ratio of the sum of the wants to the total supply of goods available to gratify wants. So here, like value, it's basically like a ratio, but it's also adding up the sums. And he quite literally wants to think of value as something that's in motion, but it really doesn't make any sense when you start kind of like breaking it down. And Murawski demonstrates this very well, because he goes through and he points out that Walrus takes this notion up from his father and kind of runs with it. But he doesn't have like mathematical acumen. He's not an engineer, and he's definitely not a physicist. And so he repeatedly has like physicists and engineers and mathematicians like explaining these concepts to him, but he never really grasps it. And he always just kind of comes away with a more kind of like a literary flourish or a metaphorical appropriation, kind of a misapplication of the ideas, giving it the pretense of a science, but it never really truly works. It does not gel.
Which is interesting how you're talking about ratios, because that's what Cournot's actual main contribution to economic theory is his idea of Cournot competition, as is named after him. And that is exactly what that is works by ratio, because this has to do with our cartels, right? We love our cartels. This is how he models how a cartel controls price, is that price is controlled by the control of supply. And so it's understood in terms of basically controlling the ratio between supply and demand. That's how you control the price, is that you increase or decrease your production. So that's how a cartel works, is that they get together and agree beforehand on total supply that they're going to put into the market, and thereby they control the price. But it's not, so when people say price fixing, that's the mechanism through which it's actually understood.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things that's happening in this is that the notion of value, even though it's being retained, it's being transformed, because here value and price are being equalized, whereas previously, kind of in classical economics, value was more of a substance that was underneath price. Like price expressed value, and only in conditions that could never actually be achieved would they ever truly like equalize with each other. You know, this is the whole thing in Petty when he talks about the natural price versus the political price.
Oh yeah. And that, no, that was a big theme. That no, you're, all the parts that you did on that were really enlightening on that regard, is how, especially how that is carried over with through to Marx too, and that there's always that, you know, it's like an unrealizable kind of ideal that everybody treats differently. I think we talked about this in like chat or something, is that they're all chasing, like each kind of branch or school or approach to economics is chasing that ideal, and they all have a different understanding of it, where it's like these neoclassical thinkers is that they are treating it much more as a realizable kind of object. But somebody, yeah.
Yeah, it's a realizable object because it's because, you know, they kind of collapse price and value into one another, where they basically are the same function. And so this kind of circumvents the problem that classical economics posed, because they create price as an equilibrium condition. So like it is always achieving the equilibrium state.
Yeah, because supply and demand are always meeting one another.
Right.
Which is exactly the whole point. That's what neoclassical economics actually establishes as the basis for modern economics. That's truly and sincerely the actual foundation of modern economic thought. Is it actually, that's what Alfred Marshall does. Alfred Marshall is one of the main thinkers who modernizes economics around 1900. And he kind of came on the heels of what's called the marginal revolution, which includes all these different people all discovering the idea of marginal utility, right? All marginal utility is just the first derivative of the utility function. So the utility function just tells you, if you input a certain amount of a good or a certain amount of leisure, it's going to tell you how much utility an economic actor derives from that. And it's just like literally a mathematical function in that sense. And so they're graphing these functions. And so they're doing then is just using calculus to take the derivative. And derivative is the first is the rate of change of a function. It tells you per each additional unit of input into the function, how much does the function change in its output? And so it's not a linear relationship, and it leads to the ability to, when you think about it that way, to be able to conceptualize things as having a diminishing marginal utility, is what they say. So that's why diamonds and water are priced differently. They use it to explain the difference between different goods, because in their primitive economic models, they just have a single thing, which is called consumption, right?
Yeah.
So they can't differentiate between goods. And that's the big problematic for them, that they inherit from the Enlightenment and from the Scottish common sense tradition, from Adam Smith, and from the sentimental political economy of luxury that we've been talking about, is that for Adam Smith and for all these people following Francis Hutcheson, the value of all these different goods is a subjective thing. So that explains why people value one thing more than another thing. But from this very embarrassingly primitive, I can't believe that people fell for this. From this embarrassingly like kind of primitive perspective of the neoclassical economic models, all goods are just the same and they can't explain the difference at all. So they need this idea of marginal utility in order to explain that consumption can change at different rates depending on what's being consumed. That's like the huge transformation for them. And it's Alfred Marshall who, his big thing is that he establishes the supply and demand equilibrium as the basis of economics, and he codifies the results of a lot of the marginal revolution economists who are all lumped together and called the neoclassicalists.
Yeah. And I don't, when I was reading through a lot of this stuff, I have this feeling that they never, you know, they are supposed to be this big break with classical economics. And, you know, I'm not saying that they're not. They definitely are. This is very radically different. But I keep getting the sense that they're smuggling classical economics in through the back door and retaining a lot of its concepts, but just changing the kind of structure around a little bit.
Murawski says like a similar thing, but yeah. It's hard to pin down exactly what it is that they're taking.
Well, the one thing that I was thinking about, I think this probably just kind of like popped out at me because, you know, I've been looking at like the value, price, labor complex so much. But, you know, another one of the neoclassical economists is Jevons, right? And Jevons, you know, he's doing a lot of work with the supply curve. And he talks about how the price side, you know, the supply curve will increase, the price will go up as more labor is spent. And so already here we have magnitudes of labor influencing price. And that's literally just the classical model right there. That's Ricardo. And then he even has recourse to the language of Adam Smith, because Adam Smith talked about value in its original instance deriving from what he called toil and trouble of labor. And when Jevons is talking about increasing the magnitudes of labor that increase price, he specifically talks about sacrifice and increasing painfulness of labor. And he's just like, well, this is subjectivist. But I don't really kind of see how, because like this is clearly maps directly back onto what Smith is talking about, which kind of helps, you know, following Petty, inaugurate this whole thing. And it's in Marshall as well, where you kind of get this whole thing, because in Marshall, price and value are synonymous. There's no value as the center of gravity anymore. But the supply side of the price determination is still, in Marshall, it's grounded in the cost of production, which means it is still grounded in labor. And then, you know, if you flip over to the demand side reflects, you know, like what you call like a subjectivist theory of value. And, you know, in Marshall, the price is constituted through both. But if we think in terms of like a logical sequence, like a time series, the supply side of, you know, the Marshall scissors has to occur before the demand side, which thus puts, you know, the labor cost prior to it. So you also here have the retention of that classical model of like value before price. It's just the fact that they've kind of shifted it around. They've kind of removed time from the equation, and they just flipped the location of like what you term price. So in that sense, like, I think you could probably kind of map a lot of what they're doing back on to classical economics. And I don't know. I don't know. Maybe I'm just being a dunce and I'm just seeing like similarities where they're not there. But this is something that really jumped out at
me. I was trying to show you some stuff that was, I think, represents exactly this in Marshall, right? It was the way that he uses the punctuated equilibriums. Their conception of the economy for somebody like Alfred Marshall works is that it's just a giant equilibrium between the supply side and the demand side. And that those two things, they balance out like an organism, right? They meet at a certain point, and that point is the balance, the fulcrum around the whole economy. And that's where everything meets. So general equilibrium that applies on that scale to everything all at once, that's like the ideal atemporal, ahistorical event that is never going to happen. But they need it to happen, because if you can't get to that point in reality, if you can only get to it in an abstract, theoretical way, then you can't build your economics like they want to do. You can't make an empirical economic science that works in this way.
Exactly.
It's like you have. Yeah.
Yeah. And they have to make it. If they don't make it atemporal, then I think it does just literally collapse back into classical economics. So it makes sense why they're so focused on this very like timeless, you know, almost like this like frozen plateau where things are moving like billiard balls. You know, the supply and demand curves are supposed to be motion, right? But it's all kind of happening in this very idealized, you know, as if the model has leapt off the page and become life itself. And I think that the Austrians were actually quite cognizant of this. They really, really disliked Marshall. And I think it's because, you know, he still kind of had this almost crypto-Ricardian perspective buried deep inside. You know, they're trying to reach a purely subjectivist, you know, theory of value. They're trying to be strictly psychological. But it's really funny because, like, they even have a notion, they have a thought experiment that they call the evenly rotating economy, you know?
Yeah.
And it's basically analogous. Yeah, it's not very common. Murray Rothbard writes about it, but I think it first appears in Mises. But they point out that this can never be instantiated empirically, which is funny too, because then that's also the Austrians going back to a position that's already been staked out in classical economics.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really great way to approach it, because then with the way that it ends up having to work out for somebody like Marshall is that they just use this idea of these punctuated equilibriums that break down the general ideal equilibrium into these small little bite-sized chunks that they can digest. And then they just try to like extend a series of those little equilibriums into the big equilibrium, right? Through a method of addition and summation, which is what the whole thing that we're talking about, because on those little equilibriums, it's like you said, they focus on the supply side. That's the whole point, is that they need to be able to bridge over to the demand side through the mechanism of this general equilibrium, but they're completely reliant on these little temporal events that they want to then add them up to infinity, but you literally can't do that in reality. You can't get to infinity in this way. So they're forever trapped in this nightmare situation. And that's the funny thing about Alfred Marshall's economic works, is that his main work, his Principles of Economics, which is like one of the defining most important books in modern economic thinking. It's like, well, that's where it all happens, right? What is that? It comes out in like 1890 or something. That's where he tries to put all the pieces together from the Austrians and from Jevons and from these different divergent thinkers. He tries to put them all together, cobble them together to make a unified economic science. But he never gets there because he never writes about the general equilibrium and how you solve this problem. He never does this thing that we're talking about. He was going to write the second volume of this work about it, and then he never wrote that book. But and so the first volume has just been updated after his death under the pretense of like, this is a textbook, so we got to keep it up to date, in order to constantly make it seem like he was somewhere close to getting to that point of doing the thing that is needed to make economics work that he never did.
That's incredible. I didn't realize that there's like a completely decapitated Marshall project there. That's really wonderful. Another thing that they have problems with too is business cycles, actually. And various neoclassical people offered some really funny solutions to why does a business cycle happen? Because it doesn't really work in the context of like a general equilibrium theory. And Jevons, have you heard about this? His sunspot theory. I love the sunspot.
You know, you sent me like the one screenshot of it that was very tantalizing.
Yeah. So basically, yeah. You know, Jevons is looking and he's seeing, you know, that these cycles are happening, and he's like, why is this happening? And so the solution that he comes up with is that they are caused by literal sunspots. And so what happens is like the sunspot happens and it impacts agriculture. And so like you have a bad harvest because the sunspot, you know, made it too shady or something. And then because like your agricultural output declines, that has a cascading effect across the rest of the economy, and hence the arrival of the business cycle.
I mean, so just for a reference, I mean, Jevons is the one who, he comes up with the Robinson Crusoe model. He's the one who formalizes the Robinson Crusoe economy. And that's the big problem with the way that all this is done, because when we talk about the supply side, what we're talking about is price theory, which I think we've mentioned a little bit in the before in this episode. And price theory deals with these rarefied utility mechanisms, these utility functions of individual economic agents. That's why the Robinson Crusoe economy is important, because that's kind of the axiomatic beginnings of laying everything out of how your economic actors behave in a vacuum in a purely theoretical situation. And they really need that. They need to have this theoretical basis, because this is the debate that they actually get into with the German historical school that Karl Menger actually gets into trouble with Gustav Schmaler, right? They have this big debate about economic method where Karl Menger, he rejects the place of historical research in economic theory completely. And he just wants to proceed in this completely deductive manner where he thinks that the job of empirical research in any possible historical research just involves basically going out and finding the axiomatic behaviors that economics can be built up with. But he doesn't really, like, that's it. He just thinks that you can observe a little bit and then you find the little axioms, right? The first axiom, every economic agent is a rational actor and they all have transitive utility preferences, so that if somebody prefers good A to good B and they prefer good B to good C, then they must prefer good A to good C, right? This is the whole basis of their theory. They need people's utility preferences to follow these mathematical formulations and be algebraic, right?
Yeah, and I guess it's, the Austrians kind of pick up, you know, this whole rejection of historical or any form of empirical research. And they, like Mises, formulates praxeology. And I think it's even more distilled down. You know, I don't know if it really indulges in like utility functions and stuff like that. You know, don't quote me on that. I could be wrong. But I know that his like first axiom is that just people act. Kind of starts to deduce things from the fact, you know, his big book is called Human Action. And so it's like a series of deductions.
I love that.
From the fact that like people act, human acts, does something in the world.
It's important to point that out. Deduction is the key term here, because that's what their method is all about, at least for the Austrians, right? They just want these axioms so that they can perform an abstract rational deduction of economic theory from these axioms. So he's just starting from the point of people act.
Yeah.
And then constructing all of economic theory from this. Like, what does that even mean? Like, it's nonsense. It's completely nonsensical. To give Karl Menger some credit is that he wasn't that stupid. All these positions are, in the way that they're formulated in the books these thinkers wrote, they're all presented in a very sophisticated way, not to give anyone a false impression.
Yeah. It's kind of funny, too, if you look at the way that the Austrian school has gone, because we always think of like Mises and Hayek together. But Hayek was actually, you know, they were buds, of course, but Hayek was a lot more open to historical and empirical research, and also, you know, kind of had like this focus on law. But after a while, like on the Mises side, a lot of that just kind of like fell away for this kind of pure economic function. And so kind of like ideologies of anarcho-capitalism form on the basis of Mises' deductive method. And so you get like Murray Rothbard is the guy that like really kind of descends from Mises. But if you dig into a lot of these communities and look at it, there's like this intense hatred for Hayek. You know, like Hayek was like, you know, this horrible bastard who went awry. And, you know, you can find all this stuff about like all that terrible socialist Hayek and really fascinating trajectories.
He really did politically subordinate his economic theories to these temporal concerns. He like prostituted out the purity of pure rational economics derived from humans act he prostituted that out to all these political causes, like forming the Mount Perlin Society.
Right. Or, you know, ended up at like the Chicago Law School. And yeah, all this is very much frowned upon with the like Austrian loyalists, I guess. I don't know. You know, these people, like, this isn't like a major current, but, you know, I like to dig into subcultures of all types. So I've spent a lot of time reading these people.
The interesting thing about specifically the deduction, the deductive method that they're using, is that that's what method dispute between the Austrians and the German historical school revolves around, is literally induction versus deduction. Yeah, that's what Karl Menger and the Austrians are arguing for, is that they want to use a deductive rational method to derive a pure theory of economics. A pure model of economics that actually is the economy that directly represents it and captures it, and that it's describing the way that the economy works, really. And that's the way that they're conceptualizing it. But the German historical school has the inductive method. That's why they're concerned about doing all this little minute historical research, is that they're following Francis Bacon. They're trying to understand the contingency of all these different economic situations and the way that economic theories themselves are part of the historical situations which they attempt to describe. And that's why they don't think that there can be a universal theory. They're not interested in looking for that. They're interested in understanding the contingent ways in which people in different societies at different points in history have attempted to understand their economic reality.
Right. Yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, that kind of like strips away the idea of a universal economy for the historicists. You can't talk about the economy really as an actual thing. Whereas if you go to the Austrian side, you know, if you begin with the axiom that people act, economics is literally, for them, the economy is just the expression of people acting. And so it cannot but be universal for them. So directions that these two go, you know, couldn't be more different.
Yeah. And that's the unfortunate thing is that, well, first of all, that they were successfully able to kick out the historical school from economics forever. It's like,
well, I think that one side's more politically advantageous than the other.
You can see this going back through the whole episode of everything that we've talked about, how much this all links together, because we've been talking about the way that the economy is constructed in such a fictionalized way, even going back to like Petty and going back to the Restoration, is that it's really the same exact thing here, where the historical school is coming out of this much broader tradition that goes back into like worldview philosophy. It's connected to sociology and to Max Weber. And it's connected to Dilthey and the historicists and people like Ranke, and goes all the way back into to connect with people like Savigny and with Humboldt and with Herder. And it has a whole tradition there. That's this whole historical school aspect of it, where it's not just about economics. It's about understanding the way that all of our laws and social systems and politics are all constructed and represent artworks that human beings make, and that they have a function that they serve for us, and that we control them, and that in order to understand them, we have to be aware of our own active role as an artist, so to speak, in building them.
Yeah. I guess one of the things that I did want to bring up with neoclassical economics is that it, you know, it, on the one hand, there was like this effort, you know, to kind of like make this like pure mathematics, you know, pure science, this kind of like crystal world of economic behavior. But neoclassical economics was also really apprehended by a lot of people as like a toolkit to be used. And I think this is very much reflective of its like engineering origins. And we touched a little bit on this, you know, with our, when we talked to our friend Thomas Murphy recently, you know, with like the Cowles Commission. And so like for them, like they're picking up Walras's model of what he calls like the auctioneer. And so the auctioneer for them is just like, or for Walras, it's just like it's a thought experiment. You know, it's where price is formed through iterations of a process, you know, until like a market reaches a point to where it can clear properly. But so like the Cowles Commission were like, oh, well, you know, we can simulate this. And then, you know, trying to use the RAND Corporation toolkit to do that, you know, kind of use game theory to achieve like an actual auctioneer that can clear markets. So that's one example of like how neoclassical economics gets applied as a, you know, kind of a managerialism. And what's important is that Cowles was, they were socialists, they were market socialists, and you can actually trace this like very strange socialist fixation on neoclassical economics. Like Bukharin, you know, in the Soviet Union, he talked about how like Marxist theory was like the analysis of capitalism, but like neoclassical economics, this will be the proper economics of socialism itself. You know, you'll use this tool to create like a socialist society. And so in that sense, like Bukharin was like, you don't really need either classical economics or Marx anymore, because, you know, we're living in now a society where the lessons of neoclassical economics can be applied properly. And the last example that I wanted to mention was that in the 50s and 60s, there is this big effort to promote like intellectual exchanges between the West and the Eastern Bloc. And as you can imagine, these were like, you know, really funded by the Ford and Rockefeller Foundation. But like it was a way of like promoting Western, you know, perspectives within the Soviet sphere. But neoclassical economics was a really common aspect of this. And I think that Cowles was also kind of linked into this as well. But there's this really interesting book by Joanna Bachmann that's called Markets in the Name of Socialism, The Left-Wing Origins of Neoliberalism. And what she's focusing on is like the rapid privatization that happened in the Eastern Bloc after the fall of the Soviet Union. And she traces, you know, the whole like narrative usually is that like the West came in and imposed it. And that is true. But the thing is, the reason that they were so able to do this was because there were networks of intelligentsia in the Eastern Bloc who had a deep history in neoclassical theory going back to those exchanges in the 50s and 60s. And quite often, a lot of the people that were promoting privatization, you know, believed they were doing so because it was a way to preserve socialism, like a market socialism, instead of destroying it. And so you can see how neoclassical economics has this whole other extremely managerial position that can, you know, it can, you can apply this in building a society and planning a society, you know, right up to the point where it installs like the most ferocious, like free market capitalism, like it's ever been seen.
Oh man. First of all, it's once you start thinking like a historicist or thinking like a Marxist about economics, it immediately becomes, just like you said, it's a tool then. And that's even to go into playing to just basic Marx 101. It's like, you know, man is the tool using animal here. So it makes sense that, yeah, so that even his descriptions of reality, I mean, they're not passive descriptions, is that they're tools that he uses to create reality. That's the whole point.
Yeah, it's just very fascinating.
There's this thread of connection to that just that influences the Americans a lot, because with the technical and engineering schools, like in University of Berlin is where a lot of these historicist economic thinkers are from, right? Like Schmaller was a professor there teaching at Berlin. Dilthey taught at Berlin. Like all these people were teachers at the University of Berlin. And this was where Marx came out of as well. All of the American universities that get set up like, at the end of the 19th century, like the University of Chicago is one of them. Oh, they all follow the model of the University of Berlin. A huge percentage of American psychologists and economists and people in the social sciences in America around 1900 is that they all studied in Germany. I don't think that this phenomenon has been studied nearly enough. Like there's not much written about it overall, or even with regards to specific fields, because, you know, I just like have this thing in my brain that just drives me nuts, is that the William Langer, who is the chair of the Harvard History Department, he was the director of the OSS Research and Analysis Division during World War II.
I've noticed that a lot.
And he was like an extremely devout, neo-Rankian German historicist thinker, and he counted the complete works of Ranke that he had as his most valued possession. It's insane to think about that. You look into it, it's like this is what Woodrow Wilson was trained in, right? This is like the background, the milieu of all of...
Murawski actually makes a similar point where he's, you know, in Machine Dreams, when he's analyzing, you know, like economists that were affiliated, you know, kind of tangentially with the Rad Lab, or, you know, were in the Rand Corporation. And he kind of notes how it kind of impacts their worldview about how they create economic theory in the post-war era. And he just has this very brief aside where he does talk about the economists that were in the OSS. And he he talks about how they come out with like this kind of like humanist intellectual perspective. And he contrasts this with like the economists that are in the Rand Corporation. So I find that really fascinating how you're drawing the line from like these historical schools down through the OSS. And, you know, I wonder if that plays into what Murawski's describing.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't think it's something that when you initially just catch a glimpse of it in one influence or something, you wouldn't think anything of it. But now that it's like we were talking about this today, everything just gets more and more compounded, because now the more that I know about this, the harder it is to avoid not reading into it more, because then you look at it turns out that a lot of the major American economists from the earlier pre-war generation, they were all, you know, the people who served on the inquiry at the end of World War One, or they were the people who were the senior scholars in the OSSRNA, people like that. That consisted of a lot of economists who studied in Germany, or you learn stuff like in Eleanor Dulles's biography, you know, she's the sister of John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles, and she was one of the highest ranking members of the Bretton Woods Conference. She was the secretariat of the Bretton Woods Conference. She was friends with Schumpeter. It's like, why does no one ever mentions anything like that? But that seems really significant to me, because all the conspiratorial people who are interested in this stuff is they don't know how to interpret that. That doesn't register with them, but seems to me to be extremely important.
Here's another one. You know, I really like this book, Monopoly Capitalism, by Paul Barron and Paul Sweezy. And this is like it's a book. They're both Marxist economists, but both of them worked for the OSS in the 40s. They were OSS economists, and Sweezy was Schumpeter's student.
Yeah, there's a lot going on there that hasn't been dug into. That's what I've been especially looking at the University of Berlin. Is like this, the mechanics institutes in the University of Berlin. It's a strange parallel to the ones that are going on in England. When we started out this thing, talked about the March of the Intellect, I didn't know about that. You just brought it in and you said, though, well, there was these engineering schools in Britain. And I didn't think it was a huge thing. But as we've gone along doing this episode, now I'm thinking like, oh, this was like everything. This is what the Royal Society was. Germany had this in Berlin that Helmholtz was involved with. And this is the foundation of the University of Berlin complex, which all of these important thinkers were part of or studied at. Then you have the St. Simonians, who are building the Suez Canal. Is that that's where they come from? It's a little bit too much, man.
I know. And it made me wonder, you know, pulling the camera back a little bit, because I didn't realize that there were mechanic institutes elsewhere. Like, I thought it was strictly a British thing. But I was always, you know, even when we did the cybernetics episode and talking about like the whole entropy steam engine kind of metaphorical complex, and I noticed how there was like this flow of French thermodynamic, like writings on thermodynamics, which were coming out of like engineering, and they were flowing into Germany. And I could never really pin down how there was this kind of like flow of pretty fairly unknown writings to the public at large. And I'm wondering now if there is like intellectual like communication between like mechanics institute type outfits, and that, you know, these theories and books and writings are being passed through those circuits.
We just got to keep going, man. I mean, I guess we have to just call this. We have to like publish this episode, because it's been like, I don't even know what the fuck I'm doing with my life anymore. Of just working on this fucking episode every day.
I don't look like I was like, oh, we're going to talk for like 20 minutes. Just do a quick rundown of you know, neoclassical economics, but looking at it here, and we're already over an hour.
But this is the last, now this is the real end. And now we can have a proper sign off here, because we didn't have one before. And I really wanted to get that, because now this has turned into like one of the most momentous events of my life, which I'll never forget. A deep trauma that PTSD after this or something. It's like,
you need a vacation.
Yeah. Thanks everybody for listening to this amazing episode. Thank you, Ed, for bearing with me as I've tried to cobble this together.
Oh no, I feel bad. I feel like you've done infinitely more work.
Yeah, I didn't have to do it. Like, nobody made me do it.
Yeah, like I've been over here just, you know, reading about the Atlas Corporation.
But you still got to send me that. You keep like teasing that all day, man, and then you don't even send
it. I'm excited because, well, it's not, I've probably built it up too much. It's just the fact that I stayed up like all night reading it, so it's still like, you know, in the forefront of my mind. You know how it is.
Yeah, unfortunately. I was up reading that the Aesthetics and Helmholtz book the other night, like up in the middle of the night, and I was like almost about to cry. I was like tears welling up in my eyes thinking about these fucking iron foundries in Berlin.
We're gonna have to take a Seacast field trip to an iron foundry.
I'm in.
Yeah, but absolutely. All right, well, let's wrap this up.
The Continuing Adventures of Admiral Edman. Brought to you by the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Admiral Edberg reporting in. We have pierced the inner sanctum of political economy, but it is empty. The form of a great room, but the very content of that room revealed to be nothing but illusion. What we found are not the great riches of an empire, but an old dusty loom and a steam engine that has long since turned cold. And with this discovery, the superstition and fright that had haunted the crew's mind has completely vanished. And upon exiting the chamber, we found that the fog had lifted. What was once mist is now the light of the sun, and a new day has dawned. This has been Admiral Edberg of the Good Tanker Suitcast, signing off.